A Texas County sheriff has turned himself into the county jail he oversees after an investigation of evidence tampering and the death of a black motorist. That story and more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. The sheriff of Williamson County indicted on felony charges stemming from the destruction of video evidence in the death of Javier Ambler. This after a police chase filmed for a so-called reality TV show. We'll have the latest. Also, where's the beef? For many in this pandemic, it's being shipped to the front door, causing ripple effects across the whole supply chain. We'll explain. Plus, disappearing coronavirus data for schools. Those stories and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 29th day of September, 14 days away from the start of early voting in Texas and night one of the presidential debates in this extraordinary election year. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. When it comes to these debates, The Economist magazine notes these televised events are at best moments of high political spectacle. The Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960 are most often cited as case in point, but they rarely change election outcomes. To borrow a phrase from former Texas Senator Lloyd Benson, neither candidate on tonight's stage is likely to be confused with JFK, though the ghost of Richard Milhouse Nixon and his 5 o'clock shadow may be present in the room, and the quadrennial scrutiny for zingers and gaffes will most certainly be too, given recent revelations about the president's tax payments or lack thereof, and his challenger's propensity to say just the right thing at the right time, or lack thereof. We'll be watching, and we suspect you will be too, or perhaps better still, listening on one of these public radio stations tonight. Many will be carrying it live. In the meantime, a big development in a story we've told you about earlier involving a different kind of so-called reality TV and policing, one that has come under intense scrutiny amid protests over systemic police abuses of power directed at people of color. The sheriff of Williamson County, north of the Texas capital city, has been indicted for evidence tampering in the investigation of the killing of a black man, Javier Ambler, the target in a would-be traffic stop that was apparently being filmed for the TV show Live PD. Tony Plohetsky, reporter for the Austin American-Statesman and KVU News, the Austin ABC TV news affiliate, joins us. He's been following this story from the beginning. Tony, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So what are the charges behind this indictment for Williamson County Sheriff Robert Chody?
Well, what's alleged by prosecutors who have been investigating this case, along with a Williamson County grand jury, is that the sheriff, as well as the county's former general counsel, had some role in the destruction of raw, unaired footage from the television show Live PD. Authorities will not really describe the nature of the charge. In other words, what specific acts the sheriff allegedly took and the general counsel allegedly took. They say that is all part of the investigation, but they do make it clear that as part of a grand jury hearing that really happened over the past several weeks, it included up to 19 witnesses. And according to Williamson County District Attorney Sean Dick, that grand jury felt as though they had sufficient evidence and sufficient probable cause to bring these charges against the sheriff and the former general counsel.
Javier Ambler, who was he and what was he doing at the time of his death?
Javier Ambler was a 40-year-old former postal worker. He was a father. He had been out for a night of poker playing with his friends. This all actually happened in March 2019. He was driving home, and a deputy in Williamson County began pursuing him because he failed to dim his headlights. Javier Ambler did not stop, and the deputies embarked on a pursuit that continued 22 minutes into Travis County and into the city of Austin, where the chase ended when Javier Ambler crashed his car. At that point, the deputies used their tasers 4 times on Javier Ambler as he was shouting and gasping, really, that he had congestive heart failure and that he could not breathe. His cause of death, according to the Travis County Medical Examiner's Office, was congestive heart failure in combination with forcible restraint.
We should point out that it's believed that a crew with Live PD, one of these cop-style reality TV shows, was with the police at the time of this chase.
That's exactly right. And when we were able to obtain body camera video, it actually shows in pretty clear view crews from Live PD taping the final moments of Javier Ambler's life. Again, Live PD often airs events, police events, as they happen live, but in this case, the show was not live in that moment. This happened around 1:30 in the morning, but they were taping and they are visibly seen in body camera footage in the scene with cameras over their shoulders taping the final moments of Javier Ambler's life.
But that video has not emerged. Is that right? It's not clear where that video is, or is it known to have been destroyed?
Live PD, soon after we first revealed details of what happened that night, confirmed that they no longer had the video. And in fact, the host of the show, Dan Abrams, said that the show was told by the Williamson County Sheriff that they had closed the investigation using other video in the case. And so at that point, Live PD destroyed the video, and that happened, they said, about 2 months later after Javier Ambler's death. But they did not confirm that the video was no longer existence until June 2020. And that is important to understand the timeline. And it was at that point that prosecutors announced both in Travis County and in Williamson County that they were opening a joint investigation about the destruction of that video.
So now an indictment of Sheriff Chody. What about a response from Ambler's family?
Ambler's family has said for months now that they want justice in this case. They've been very clear that they believe that there is a cultural, systemic issue within the Williamson County Sheriff's Office from the top down. So they really praised the indictments yesterday, but of course, are deeply disturbed about this entire event and deeply disturbed too that the two deputies actually continue to be employed by the Williamson County Sheriff's Office and are still on the streets of Williamson County.
We'll link to the latest from Tony Plohetsky, reporter for the Austin American-Statesman and KVU News. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Tony.
Absolutely.
Questions over the accuracy of how the state's tracking coronavirus cases in its public schools remain in question. On Friday, the state rescinded a part of its recently released data that's been tracking district-wide coronavirus cases over case number discrepancies, they say. Kayla Harris has been following this as state politics and education reporter for the San Antonio Express News and the Houston Chronicle. Kayla, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What has the state actually done? What does that mean, rescinded part of its data?
Yeah, so the state had published a dashboard of cases in public schools, and that came up about 2 weeks ago. But then last week, they decided to also release a spreadsheet listing the data by district. So instead of just seeing the overall cases on the dashboard, you could also download this spreadsheet and search by district, by area, etc. That data file has since disappeared from the website, and now there's a little note up top saying that there were, quote, issues with that spreadsheet, and that's why it was taken down.
What's the problem with the data? Where's the discrepancy?
There were several issues with it. So there were some issues that were apparent immediately. You could add up the total cases on the spreadsheet, and we're getting somewhere around 6,700 total cases, whereas on the actual dashboard, it was 6,300. So that was a discrepancy that the state couldn't answer for immediately. There were also differences in what was listed on the spreadsheet and what the districts were actually reporting. So the district said, you know, my number is off by one or two, or that, you know, this is a difference here. I don't have this many coronavirus cases, or actually I have two more than this. And there were also issues with their enrollment numbers. So some of the districts said that they had, you know, 102,000 students and not 110,000. So there were little errors all over the spreadsheet.
If you can see that the numbers literally don't add up, how is this making it out into the public in the first place? Why are there so many problems with the numbers when it comes to coronavirus cases and reporting those cases in Texas?
Yeah, that's a great question that I'm still asking. There's no real bottom line for it. The state has encountered issues with data before, but one of the answers I keep getting over and over is that this is just an unprecedented influx of information, and there's never been such a need for real-time public health information. And public health is a sector that's been super underfunded for decades. So we're overworking our people, overusing our resources, stretching everything thin. And now expected to relay this to the public in real time. And so it's just a huge stressful event. It's never been seen before at this level. It's not really an excuse for bad data. It's just one of the reasons why it's happening.
But it would seem to me that a parent with a student in a public school would certainly have the right to know what's going on in their school. And how is a parent going to find out? How are they going to keep up if the data is pulled from public view?
So the schools report directly to the state. And so if a parent has a student in a public school, that is public information. They can probably reach out directly to their school and might even get more specific information than what the state is reporting, because the state is reporting district level information, which, remember, sometimes can include dozens of schools. Some schools are reporting it on their website. Some districts are reporting it on their website or also reporting it to the local health department. And those numbers will be more accurate than what the state is putting out right now, which at this point is actually nothing because they haven't updated the numbers yet.
But I can only imagine that parents, teachers, students, staff must all be rather skeptical of this data to begin with. This must only add to concerns about accuracy. How are parent and teacher groups responding?
I haven't heard from a lot of parent and teacher groups right away, but there is definitely a widespread concern that you just need accurate data. That's the basis of all decision making in this crisis when we're sending students back to school in person. So I do want to stress that the number of cases that have been reported so far is very, very small. It's less than 1%. It's less than a half of 1%. But it is really important to be able to track that and see where outbreaks are happening and stop it before it gets too bad. And so that's, you know, a concern for parents and a concern for teachers and everyone who's involved with the public school system.
Kayla Harris reports on state politics and education for the San Antonio Express News and the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Kayla, thanks again.
Thanks.
On this Tuesday, let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Howdy, David. We're hearing reactions about the show's top story, the indictment of the Williamson County Sheriff in connection with the evidence surrounding the tasing death of Javier Ambler, who died as cameras from the live PD reality TV show rolled. On our Facebook page, John E. Davis says, "What's that saying people always have when it comes to dealing with the police? So yeah, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to worry about." Jeremy Garner asks, "Isn't this guy, Robert Chody, the sheriff, the guy that gave out gift cards to officers that made exciting TV by getting into chases or pulling guns," referring there to some reporting from previous reporting from our guest Tony Plahetsky that the Williamson County Sheriff did indeed give out things like steakhouse gift cards to officers that did use force. And Nando Caban Menendez says, "People keep saying bad policing is due to a few bad apples, huh?" Just some of the reactions out there, David. I'll be back with more from social later in the program.
Your comments, we'd love to hear from you. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar will have more of your comments in 35 or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We mentioned tonight's presidential debate, the first of three before the 2020 election, and though that's top of the ballot in November, it's hardly the only contest voters will tackle. Folks in the Houston suburb of Bel Air will decide on charter amendments that could, if passed, make it nearly impossible to build new sidewalks within city limits. So why is that such a big issue? Well, as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, some folks point to Hurricane Harvey.
Sidewalks aren't the first thing that come to mind when people think about the 2020 election, but they're a top issue for Mike Jacobs. Jacobs says the city of Bel Air is ignoring the wishes of many residents by building sidewalks where they're not wanted. He says things came to a head in 2018 during the most recent round of construction.
One, there was a lack of adequate notification prior to construction. Two, there was destruction of multi-generational trees or expensive landscaping. And three, just getting something they didn't want. More than one person told me that they came home just to see their front yards torn up, and they had no idea why.
Jacob says his coalition wants to force the Bel Air City Council to consult residents before new construction takes place. And he says a big concern in this regard is flood mitigation.
During Hurricane Harvey, roughly one out of every three homes in Bel Air flooded. With the move to remove trees and add more concrete so soon after Harvey, the petitioners wanted to ensure that the hydrological impact of any future impervious material would be offset so as not to increase flooding risk.
Patricia Bernstein with the group Save Bel Air isn't buying the flood mitigation argument. She points to the new construction of massive homes and driveways in Bel Air, which she argues have more of an impact on flooding than 5-foot sidewalks, and which the amendments ignore.
And I really resent the fact that a small group of angry people who have gotten crosswise with the city over time want to control every other resident of Bel Air's opportunity to appeal to want a sidewalk on their block, no matter how badly it's needed.
Bernstein lives across the street from Bel Air High School on a block with no sidewalks. She says traffic is very intense when school starts and lets out.
Students are in the street all the time. It's very dangerous.
Bel Air city government doesn't have an official position on the charter amendments, although Mayor Andrew Friedberg has written about his opposition to the proposed charter amendments on his blog. Friedberg says the election is less about sidewalks than about how the city self-governs.
Whether you're for or against sidewalks isn't so much the point. And the question for the voters to decide is whether the city charter should be amended to take the question of sidewalks away from the ordinary legislative process.
The amendments were initially due for a vote in May. Because of the pandemic, that vote was postponed until Election Day, November 3rd. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We are past the point of the pandemic where you couldn't find beef in your local grocery store, but the temporary scarcity created some new buying habits. After all, you can buy pretty much anything you want to online, so why not steak, right? Well, it's an option many are taking advantage of these days, and as the Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports, that could have a big impact up and down the supply chain.
Around the end of March, Chris Swenson thought he had a problem with his website. Chris is the head of Swenson Ranches, a Central Texas cattle operation that's been in his family since 1882. These days, direct-to-consumer sales are part of the business, so once a week, Chris updates what's for sale on the website.
You know, we'll list, you know, here's 10 sirloin steaks available, here's, you know, 50 pounds of hamburger, you know, whatever.
So he was doing that one evening, punching in all the latest inventory. But then he noticed that something was wrong. Each time he updated the site with a new item, the one he'd entered just before would go back to zero.
I'd say, oh my gosh, I must not update. I must hit the wrong button. I mean, I'm not a whiz at the internet stuff.
This kept happening until Swenson realized that the cause wasn't a glitch. It was demand.
People were waiting for us to put stuff up and were just ordering as soon as we put stuff up.
People were desperate to buy Swenson's beef. Before the pandemic, his direct-to-consumer business was pretty slow. You might get 5 or 6 orders per week around the Austin area. Post-coronavirus, that number jumped to over 70 orders a week, and he got calls from all over.
We had a couple from Florida want to know if we would, you know, drive a whole cow over to it. You know, can't take that much time off.
Other ranchers who sell their beef directly to consumers experience similar spikes in demand. That's because the pandemic exposed weaknesses in the beef supply chain. See, there are lots of middlemen in the beef business. When a rancher raises a cow, they typically sell it to someone else who will fatten it up. That person sells it to a meat packer, which will butcher the animal, package the beef, and then send it to the grocery store. But over 70% of U.S. beef gets processed by just 4 big companies: Tyson Foods, JBS Beef, Cargill, and National Beef. Coronavirus outbreaks among their workers forced many of their plants to close, causing a beef shortage. Customers couldn't find beef in stores, and ranchers had nowhere to sell their cattle.
But that at least opened up everybody's eyes of, like, what the heck is going on? Like, are we really this dependent on these plants?
That's Don Thilmany, a professor of agriculture and resource economics at Colorado State University. And most ranchers are that dependent on those plants. But Swenson and others like him are an exception. They typically work with small local processors to butcher their cows and then ship directly to consumers. That effectively inoculated them from the pandemic's effect on the broader beef industry.
You know, the analogy everyone always wants to use is being an independent music label versus on a big label, or a craft beer versus a large format brewery. It's just, it's almost an entirely different business model.
Selling directly to consumers isn't necessarily more profitable, but ranchers have more control over their product. That's attractive for those who want to raise specialty cattle like Wagyu or grass-fed, or are unhappy dealing with the big meatpacking companies. Ranchers have very little control over the price they get for their cows, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture is currently investigating price-fixing allegations levied at the big four meatpackers. Still, even though the direct-to-consumer model has grown since the pandemic, it's still a very small portion of the overall beef market.
It takes a very unique and dedicated type of business person, because it's very multifaceted to do your own brand of beef, basically.
It's not easy. In addition to all the challenges that just come with raising cattle, you've also got to manage a website, do all the marketing, and get it delivered to the customer. Sure, you take the middleman out of the supply chain, but on the other hand, now you are the supply chain. Plus, getting a cow processed into cuts of beef takes special skills and equipment. Right now, the people who do that work are swamped. Josh Welsh runs a mobile processing service out of Huntsville called Pasture to Plate Processing.
I'm very busy. I'm working on average a 60 to 70 hour week.
Welsh started his business during the pandemic. He travels to customers throughout Southeast Texas, processing cattle and other animals on site. He's been successful so far, but the question is whether he and others in the beef industry who bypass big packers will be able to stay busy once the pandemic's over.
The standard processing system as we know it is never going to go away, but there will be a larger amount of people who will step away from it. And I think we're going to see more small processors take off.
So while the direct-to-consumer model may be more popular on the other side of the pandemic, it likely won't disrupt the entire system. But a supply chain where smaller processors working with local ranchers have more market share might be more resilient than relying on colossal packing companies. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Central Texas congressman says the American public deserves more information about President Trump's finances after the New York Times reported he paid $750 in federal income taxes in both 2016 and 2017. Austin area Democrat Lloyd Doggett has for months sought to obtain supporting documents as a member of the House Ways and Means Committee. He says the nation specifically needs to know about more than $300 million in debt the president owes in the next few years.
He faces an enormous debt coming due in a very short time, and we have yet to get the details of to whom that debt is owed, whether it's someone here in the United States or someone abroad. Raises some serious national security questions.
Trump continues fighting in court to keep his financial records hidden from two House committees, New York's Attorney General and Manhattan's District Attorney. The Texas manufacturing sector continues to slowly recover from historic declines following the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. The Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas reports factory activity in September expanded for a fourth month in a row. Economist Emily Kerr says a few industries are driving the growth, such as food manufacturing and home construction.
There are sections of the manufacturing sector that are actually seeing increased business because of this current climate, although the majority are seeing a negative impact. And that negative impact is on the order of a 30% decline.
Kerr says about 60% of the manufacturing executives surveyed by the Fed this month reported their revenues remain below pre-pandemic levels. Governor Greg Abbott will give an update today on deadly amoeba found in the city of Lake Jackson's water supply that have been linked to a six-year-old boy's death this month. Abbott had declared a state of disaster for Brazoria County, but Lake Jackson is the only community in the county where the boil water advisory remains in effect. And a temporary installation honoring Black people who have lost their lives due to racism and police brutality is now in Houston. Joy and Elise Proctor started the Say Their Names Memorial earlier this year in Portland, Oregon on Juneteenth. Houston rapper and activist Trey The Truth partnered with them to bring the memorial to his city. During an event Monday night, he said it would help keep the victims and their families in the public consciousness.
And I feel with what we're doing with things like this, we'll be able to spark a whole new wave of helping people understand why we say their names across the world.
The Say Their Names Memorial is in Houston's Emancipation Park. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, over 5 million Texas children have daily access to nutritious school meals, many including local products. Learn more at farmfreshfriday.org.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As we approach Election Day, most of the headlines about election security involve questions about mail-in voting or interference from Russia. The integrity of systems in places like Hamilton County, Texas, doesn't garner quite as much national attention. But maybe it should. Hamilton County is a rural area about an hour west of Waco, and earlier this month, its election administrators were hacked. The malware attack was fairly unsophisticated, but still adequate to breach the county's cybersecurity systems, which are similar to many other election administrations around the state, particularly in rural parts of Texas. This story was brought to light by reporters from ProPublica, including Jessica Huseman, who joins us now on The Standard. Jessica, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I love being here.
Well, it's great to have you with us. First, walk us through the mechanics of what actually happened there in Hamilton County. Were they specifically targeted from what you can tell?
As far as I can tell, no. The way in which they were breached is a very basic bug that's been going around the internet for quite some time now. It's well known to election security offices and IT companies. And what likely happened was that someone in the county, it's not clear to us who, was initially phished by this company and was sent malware that allowed hackers to have access to their inbox, which gave them access to other email addresses within the county. And it just spread from there. This is sort of malware 101. But what it did do was shut down the county's ability to actively send emails for more than a week. And it's not even clear to us now that the problem is solved.
Given all the attention that's been focused on the election, is there any sign that perhaps this was testing the vulnerability of systems there in Hamilton County?
No, I don't think that it was meant to test. We were able to isolate the malware that Hamilton County received, and it's coming from international locations. They were, you know, trolling for valuable information like social security numbers or personally identifiable information that it's either valuable on their own or valuable enough to sell.
Now, how common are the systems there in Hamilton County when you compare them, say, with other places across Texas? I mean, is Hamilton County in any way unique in not having a kind of a defense against a simple malware attack?
You know what? No, it isn't. And I think that the way that Hamilton County does its IT is very, very similar to small counties, not only in Texas, but across the country. You know, these small counties typically do not have an in-house IT person, nor do they have the expertise within the county to really arm themselves against these things. And so what they end up doing is contracting out with private IT companies that serve small and medium-sized counties. They contract with a company called BizProtect, which is based out of Glen Rose, Texas. And BizProtect did not return several emails, emailed questions, several phone calls, several voicemails. And so it's really not clear to us what BizProtect has done to remedy this for the county.
But you doesn't know, the state have in place a protocol for all counties to follow? I mean, the danger here, it seems to me, is that these systems could be vulnerable come Election Day or as we approach the elections or when those results are being tabulated.
Right. I mean, you know, Texas uniquely has very little authority over what the counties do. So while the state can set recommended minimum standards, there's really no way for the state to enforce those things. And Texas is making progress in this regard. They send out a contractor to do election security audits in every county that requests one. Hamilton County did one of those in the fall. They're doing one again this spring. And what we do know is that counties are receptive to that. But there is really no state law that requires any minimum security standards for these counties.
Well, let me just put the question to you as pointedly as I know how. How vulnerable is Texas's electronic communication infrastructure as we approach the elections? Should people be concerned that there won't be an accurate tabulation because of these gaps?
You know what? No, I don't think so. So the little ray of sunshine I can leave you with is that the tabulation and vote casting process in Texas is very, very separate from the email infrastructure of the counties. You know, this is widespread and not very fun for Hamilton County, but the likelihood that an attack this unsophisticated would make it impossible or difficult to get a reliable vote count, I think, is next to zero. The security infrastructure around the voter registration system in Texas is separate from email infrastructure, as is tabulation, as are the voting machines. So I don't want to paint them as perfectly, amazingly secure, but this specific problem would not impact those systems.
Jessica Hoosman is a reporter for ProPublica based in Texas. We'll have a link to her latest story at texasstandard.org. Jessica, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
Hi, this is Mary Beth Rogers. I had become friends with Ann Richards many years before she ever ran for any public office, and then I actually ran her general election campaign in 1990 when she achieved the governor's office, and then became her chief of staff for the first 18 months when she served as governor of Texas. When Ann Richards became governor of Texas in 1990, she was the first woman to really break through into the power structure of the state of Texas. It was a time of a tremendous hope. She ran on the campaign to create a new Texas, where the doors would be open to all who had previously been denied access to state government offices and policies. And that was largely women, people of color. And I was fortunate enough to be along for the ride. You know, there's a lot of controversy about different styles of management of men and women, but on the whole, people who have relationship with their followers and can encourage them and inspire them can do remarkable things in government. And I think Anne was a rare inspirational leader that few of us have seen. You know, a lot of politicians are pretty pedestrian, and there's no doubt that Anne Richards had a flair and drew people to her. After Anne's death, people would come up to me and say, "Oh, I remember I saw Anne in an airport and she stopped and talked to me, and then I got a note from her afterwards." So there was a very personal touch that Anne brought to public office. If we got an inquiry about a problem that somebody was happening, we would assign someone to go figure out how to help them solve it. We had to staff up the Office of Correspondence in the governor's office because we were getting 7,000 pieces of mail a week. And you can't always solve somebody's problem, but you can let them know you've heard. And maybe that was unique, or a particular kind of female leadership. I don't know. I think any good politician, any good office holder should be responsive to constituents. I think one of the interesting things that's happening in 2020 is the number of women military veterans who are actually running for office. Women who were piloting helicopters in danger zones, women who might have been injured, women who were awarded medals for acts of bravery, not only in Texas, but across the country, where you have female military vets who are making their mark in the political world. This is Mary Beth Rogers, and I'm author of the biography, Barbara Jordan, an American Hero, and you're listening to the wonderful Texas Standard.
Mary Beth Rogers was also the chief of staff for former Texas Governor Ann Richards. Richards would have turned 87 this month. In the race to develop a COVID-19 vaccine, a number of pharmaceutical companies have entered the home stretch, the human trial phase. One of those trials is underway at Baylor Medical Center in Dallas. KERA's Becca Moore spoke with one of the participants in that trial.
Ashley Agura is the perfect candidate for this vaccine trial. As a physician's assistant, she spends 12 hours a day taking care of COVID-19 patients.
You know, we kind of glue your mask on for the day, your N95 plus a droplet mask over that eye shield, and then go visit with those patients and see, you know, how they're doing, check in with their symptoms.
Before Agura received her first injection of the experimental vaccine, she watched a video about how the process would work and the risks involved. She gave her informed consent and underwent a few tests. Then she received the first dose of either the vaccine or the placebo. About 3 weeks later, she got the second dose. No one, not even the doctors, knows which she received. The first dose didn't bother her much, just left her with a sore arm. But after the second injection,
I definitely had much more arm soreness, and I actually felt a little bit, not ill the next day, but I definitely had like body aches and a low-grade temperature, which was not bothersome. Like, I worked the whole day and I just took some Advil.
That's a good sign, says Dr. Mizgebe Berhe. He's the lead researcher on this trial.
You are actually trying to simulate a natural infection. So if you had COVID-19 virus, you are expected to develop chills, pain, maybe fever.
Berhe says this trial uses the body's own RNA. Messenger RNA, or mRNA, tell the body which proteins to build. Scientists have found a way to code mRNA to produce proteins that fight COVID-19. This technology has been around for a few years, but it hasn't been used in a vaccine before.
The whole concept is, how do I expose the body to a specific protein of interest so the body can mobilize a more targeted immune response?
The pharmaceutical company Pfizer is sponsoring this vaccine trial. Baylor's just one of the medical centers involved. Pfizer's CEO Albert Bourla told CBS's Face the Nation that enough data will be collected by November to take the vaccine to the FDA for approval.
But of course, that doesn't mean that it works. It means that we will know if it works.
Substantial public skepticism could throw a wrench in things, though. About 1 in 3 Americans say they wouldn't get a free COVID-19 vaccine approved by the FDA, according to a recent Gallup poll. Dr. Peter Hotez is the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He says he understands the concerns, especially because of Operation Warp Speed. That's the federal government's effort to speed up the development of COVID-19 treatments and vaccines.
The communications out of Operation Warp Speed has been largely non-existent, and I'm not sure for something of this profile and magnitude and concern whether that will be adequate. So there's going to have to be a higher level of public communication with the American people.
Pfizer CEO Bourla says that's part of the reason he declined federal funding for his company's vaccine. He wants to keep politics out of it.
When you get money from someone, that always comes with strings. They want to see how you're going to progress, what type of moves you're going to do. They want reports. I didn't want to have any of that.
Agura, the trial participant, says she trusts the science behind the Pfizer vaccine, but she is concerned about the long-term effectiveness.
It's still too early to know, you know, are you going to have antibodies going into next year, you know, because that's just not enough time to test that.
In the meantime, Dr. Berhe, the lead researcher on the Baylor trial, says Pfizer wants to recruit 10,000 more volunteers for its human trials, specifically minorities.
If the minority are not enrolled in a study, it's very difficult to understand the efficacy of, you know, this intervention in that sector of the population.
Even though FDA approval is not guaranteed, Pfizer has already started manufacturing its RNA vaccine so it can be ready to distribute it as soon as possible. The CDC director recently told Congress that's not going to be possible until next year. But Berhe is optimistic it'll happen before the end of this year, and he expects an accelerated FDA approval process. He says that's not unheard of, especially if there's overwhelming data that the vaccine is effective. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
Well, the Dallas Stars Stanley Cup hopes ended last night with a 2-0 loss to the Tampa Bay Lightning. Tampa beat Dallas in six games, bringing an unusual postseason to an end. The playoffs were played entirely in bubbles in Edmonton and Toronto. Well, despite the loss, it was a memorable season for the Stars. This was Dallas's first Stanley Cup Finals appearance in some 20 years. There's more of the Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Since the death of George Floyd, much has been written about the aggressive and sometimes violent responses police have had against protesters. Many have pointed out how overwhelmingly male American police forces really are. Roughly 12% of those in American police departments are women. And that's only up a few percentage points from 25 years ago. Could more women working in police help change the culture? Here to talk about that is Kara Raby Hemp. She is a professor and associate dean at Illinois State University and has written several books on women and policing. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
I think some listeners may wonder if the basis of the question is somewhat sexist. I mean, statistically, women are less likely to be violent, fewer in prison, less likely to fire a weapon and that sort of thing. But that's what the statistics say. The question is, would hiring more women make police less violent, or is there more than that that needs to be taken into account?
I think there's more than that that needs to be taken into account. We do know the positive benefits that women bring to policing. For instance, we have been able to empirically test and shown that female police officers are less likely to use force against citizens, especially excessive force. What this means is their increased representation in policing might mean more peaceful police-citizen relationships. We also know they're less likely to be named in citizen complaints and citizen lawsuits, which saves taxpayers and agencies millions of dollars. Female officers are more likely to take reports of domestic violence and sexual assault seriously, to follow up on those reports, which could prevent future violent attacks for victims and survivors. So we know that women have challenged the myth that policing requires nothing but brawn to get the job done, while proving they have what it takes to do the job. But more empirical research is needed before we can say that women are a solution to violence within policing.
Why so few women in policing? 12%?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Recently, it has become very apparent that the progress that women were making in their representation in American police agencies, even in the 1990s and into the 2000s, has stalled. There's several factors that we know that are contributing to the underemployment of women police. The first one is that we know that current recruitment practices in policing, generally speaking, tend to overemphasize upper body strength, and women are just physiologically disadvantaged with upper body strength. Now, one of the major frustrations of this is we really don't know if that's a necessary physical requirement to do policing well or to successfully predict policing. But police agencies that are looking to increase the representation of female police officers should carefully consider their testing requirements. The second thing is that if we want to retain a diverse workforce, agencies have to begin to address the continued resistance to women within the police culture. A very recent survey asked female police officers about their experiences. Three quarters of them agreed that the culture in police agencies is male dominated and not very women friendly.
But I guess that's you're hitting at a question that's central to this inquiry, and that is how much of what we've been seeing on the streets is a reflection of an internal culture, a sort of a macho culture, if you will, or are we missing something bigger?
What we know is that when we add women to police agencies, we know this question of whether or not they would make a difference is not as easy as a recipe of adding women and stirring, right? So we don't want to give that impression. But one of the things that we can begin to look at very early in research suggests that women do serve as change catalysts within police organizations. So their presence kind of destabilizes that monolithic male working class culture that we typically see in police agencies, although that is really painting with a broad brush. As change catalysts, women challenge the way that things have always been done. They integrate diverse ways of knowing based on their unique socialization experiences as women in the United States. And then organizations rethink how they've done what they've always done. This does result in innovation in policy, increased creativity and problem solving. So when we look at police agencies specifically with female leadership and greater female representation, we see innovative recruitment and retention policies that address some of the issues we discussed earlier, the establishment of family medical leave, light duty policies, and more inclusive leadership style. So we know that women are having an impact in the agencies in which they're working.
Kara Raby-Hemp is an associate dean and professor at Illinois State University, where she specializes in criminal justice and policing. Professor, thanks again.
Thanks for your time.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, what you gonna be doing tonight, Wells?
Gonna
be watching
like...
anything on TV or maybe listening on the public radio station? Or...
Yeah, you know, I do have some streaming binges to catch up on, some shows I've really been eyeing, you know, new season of Midsummer Murders. No, I think you're talking about the presidential debate there, tuned into this and any other public radio station to get your coverage tonight. And that's what our friends and listeners are chatting about as well. We're hearing from folks whether or not they're tuning in or not. Casey Brunette says, yes, I'm such a political nerd and debate nerd that regardless of the current circumstances, I'm excited to kick off debate season. However, some folks have just kind of are tapping out already, you could say. David Warren Maurer says, I've seen enough political train wrecks in 2020 to tide me over for the next few elections. And I just got to say, I do wonder what the turnout, what the numbers will be like, because there's just been so much 2020 here in 2020 that whether or not folks can sort of take this will be an interesting thing to see. And obviously, just one sign of how divisive things are, some comments coming in on the Facebook, Texas Standard Facebook page about stolen and defaced signs from Gabrielle Gordon. She notes that she just picked up some Biden-Harris signs in Fort Worth, and the office, she writes, was full of people buying more signs because so many were stolen. And Emily Haygood also similarly notes that someone's been riding around her neighborhood in a golf cart stealing Trump signs. So obviously, tensions and, partisan affiliations running high ahead of the election and tonight's debate kickoff. So it should be an interesting one, to be sure, David.
Certainly, yeah. One of the things that I think is concerning to a lot of people who are, well, concerned about civic participation and that kind of thing, is whether or not these debates actually contribute to a greater understanding of the positions of the politicians, or if it tends to sort of emphasize the horse race aspect of it, because everyone sort of focuses on the gaffes or the misstatements or just, you know, did someone get
zingers.
A zinger in there? Right, zingers. All of that kind of stuff. And I'd be really interested to hear what our listeners think about that aspect of it. And I know that that's one of the reasons why a lot of people won't be tuning in tonight, because a lot of people are really skeptical about how much substance comes out of this. On the other hand, there's a whole lot to talk about. And it will be interesting to hear how the candidates try to position themselves
to hear from some people out there who are maybe watching these debates with that in mind. You know, maybe is there someone out there in America in 2020 who is still undecided and is watching tonight's debate
question.
To sort of make a decision? I'd love to hear from that person. Well, scanning the headlines here, interesting one out of the Texas capital city and the Austin American Statesman. Apparently, city of Austin has identified $15 million to be made available to local entertainment businesses. We're talking about live music venues, bars, iconic restaurants, etc., who have been impacted by the COVID-19 shutdown. Obviously, its impact on the entertainment industry here, a big one.
Yep, city builds itself as a live music capital of the world and all that. Not much live music happening right now, of course, except online. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but you can visit us online at texasstandard.org, and we hope you will. Till tomorrow, I'm David, along with Wells, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.